All right, welcome on to Coaches Ranking Part 2 here on the Hollinger and Duncan podcast. We're also live on Locker Room as well. You can get those speaker requests in now. We will be taking those at the end, but we will be answering your calls in the order in which they were received. But first, a reminder that today's episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra. Are you happy because you win, or do you win because you're happy? And only 2.6 carbs and 95 calories. It's only worth it if you enjoy it. Stay tuned for the Ultra, maybe player, maybe coach of the week coming up in the episode.
It might be a coach of the week.
It is quite possible. It was last week. So let's pick up here with our coach rankings. A reminder on how that works. John is going to take a sip of his coffee, and then we're going to pick coaches in the order that we would select them if we were trying to hire a coach for a random team for the next 4 years, essentially. So this isn't necessarily coach of the year, who's done the best job right now. It's just looking forward who we think would do the best job for our team. So last week we left off pretty much in the middle. Who would you like to start with here, John, to talk about kind of in the 16 to 20?
We covered 13 of my top 15. We did not get to my number 14 and number 15 guys.
Let's hear it.
Number 14. It's a little interesting when you talk about the 4 year part of this, but Tom Thibodeau.
Yeah. Just get new players every year?
you're gonna need them probably with all the wear and tear.
That was the import there.
Extremely high level of preparation with all of his teams. And I do think, you know, he was his own worst enemy in Minnesota, but he got the T-Wolves to the playoffs, which certainly nobody else has been able to do that, right? His tenure in Chicago was really good. He, his history is that he's not going to play well in the sandbox. So that's a little bit of an issue when you talk about a multi-year stay and what's going to happen to his players over the longer term with the minutes loads.
Well, just let CAA run your whole franchise. That'll take care of any front office drama.
Well, that's true too.
And you can ensure you'll get favorable coverage from ESPN too, so no one will ever get fired. Yeah. It'll be great.
Yeah. So I do think if you're in a win now mode, which actually the Knicks were not, which is what made this such a weird hire. But if you're in a win now mode, I mean, he's certainly the best guy left on the list, I would say.
Yeah, that's interesting. For Tibbs as a development, didn't see it as much in Minnesota. Certainly saw it in Chicago. He's not a huge fan of playing rookies. He'll do some inexplicable stuff like starting Keith Bogans in Chicago and starting Elfrid Payton in New York. He's definitely going to do things his way. Mm-hmm. If he could just chill by like 10% and just get a little bit less crazy, then I think he would rocket up this list for me. But I mean, we're joking aside about CAA. We are talking about a random team here, and you are talking about him potentially wearing out his welcome. You are talking about him playing RJ Barrett 40 minutes a game and Julius Randle 40 minutes a game.
He played 46 in a regulation game last week.
Seems like
that's
a lot.
Amazing. That never happens anymore.
Yeah. And Tom would say, hey, the guys who can handle it, I play them. But then they also kind of break down the way Luol Deng and Jimmy Butler did. And now Jimmy Butler can only play 30 minutes a game during the regular season. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that one is a classic. I mean, he was basically... And the story out of that Nick Friedell wrote, talking about Thibodeau's demise in Chicago, where in a meaningless regular season game in 2014, with Joakim Noah on a knee that would eventually require surgery and he would never be the same after that Defensive Player of the Year season, they go into Charlotte in a game that didn't even mean anything for seeding, was my recollection. And they play him, 45 minutes or some shit in that game. Yeah. I can't remember the exact number, but it was something just utterly preposterous. And so, yeah, that is all a problem. I mean, for me, I like to build something a little bit more sustainable. I also think that Thibodeau has gotten outcoached in the playoffs when he's been in there. He had absolutely zero answers against Houston switching in 2018 with the Wolves. His Bulls teams lost to Washington in 2014. 2013, they beat a Brooklyn team. That was pretty good. 2015, I thought they actually had a pretty decent chance of beating that Cavs team, and they kind of imploded. He ended up getting fired. So I think he's worse in the playoffs, partially due to that inflexibility. But you can't argue with the results either in New York this year. You just wonder about the sustainability. So I had him a little lower. I had him at 19, but still in this 11 to 20 group. So I don't think we're necessarily that far off on him. I mean, with the job that he's done this year, it's hard not to at least have him in the teens. But I would have guessed before the start of the year that it'd be worse for him.
Yes, I agree with that. Yeah. So I think he's...
So he was 14 for you?
Yes.
I guess he... it's going to be real interesting to see what happens in New York these next couple of years. And for whatever reason, like a bunch of stars seem to really like him, unless their name is Karl-Anthony Towns.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, even the guys he ran into the ground to kind of view him favorably. So
yeah, and I think the other thing you can say too is it's looking like Minnesota is a little bit of the outlier there now, and whether that's because he had personnel power or just because Karl-Anthony Towns just didn't want to play defense for him or whatever, it's looking like he has this magic touch when it comes to improving a team's defense. I guess it really even kind of did happen in Minnesota. If you look at what happened just before he got there and what happened just afterwards, it was just he couldn't get it that high because, you know, he was dealing with Towns and Wiggins.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so who is the other guy that you had in your top 15?
And he's kind of the complete opposite of Thibodeau in some ways. Lots of staying power, although I think he may be a coaching free agent this summer. Terry Stotts.
Yeah, that's... I have him down in a tier below. I have him at number 23 overall. Okay. And just the defense has just been unacceptably bad for 2 years.
That's the biggest thing. If you want to take shots at him, he's just never been a good defensive coach anywhere he's been. The defenses have maxed out at average. And you could argue, you know, personnel and whatnot have played into that. And I think this year's team, for them to be as bad as they are defensively, like with their personnel, they shouldn't be good, but they shouldn't be this bad either.
Well, and he's starting to kind of dip into the desperate coach playbook
recently. I mean,
Jason Quick wrote an article about this.
And it's what happens, I think. I mean, it's his ninth season there. I think it's his ninth season, right? Like, I think it's just at the point where it's over. They need a decent, different voice. I mean, the same thing happened to Nate McMillan there. It was just like you woke up one day and it was just like, it's over. Like, what if, you know, it's just time to do something different. And that inevitably can happen to lots of coaches in different situations. So I don't necessarily hold that against him. I thought he did a good job winning that playoff series against Denver 2 years ago. I think the Blazers in general have been a pretty decent playoff team. And offensively, I think he's done some good stuff in the time he's been there. And really, even before then, in Atlanta and in Milwaukee? Was that the other place he was? It was a long time ago. It's just a memory now.
Milwaukee, and then he kind of rehabbed himself under Rick Carlisle in Dallas, and then he got hired in
Portland. That's right. Yeah. You know, the ability to, he's been able to earn the trust of his star players, I think. He has been able to, you know, have a decent amount of success for an extended period. So I think that's a real positive for him. I mean, the guys who were left on this list, I mean, none of them, except I guess like Scott Brooks, have been able to stay in one place for as long as Stotts did and have pretty decent success. So that's why I put him 15th. Like I do, like if he's out in Portland after this year, I do think he'll get another job.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me either. Another thing that you didn't mention that probably it deserves to go in his ledger and is part, I think, of the development aspect with him, and you've written about this extensively is the way that they've developed players.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, thank you for mentioning that, because that's another positive for him and his staff. And I think, you know, there's an organizational commitment to that there too. But I think with it, you know, with him and Mike Malone both, I think that gets overlooked a little, that they're able to win in the present while still accomplishing player development for the future.
Now, the argument against him is, I think, yes, in Denver or that Denver series in 2019, it looked pretty good for him. Other times, I can't really point to just like great adjustments that he's made in playoff series. He played Zach Collins more in that series. I think that's helped. He's had a little bit too much of an addiction to traditional bigs, I would say. And then whenever they've gone away from that structure of the drop coverage, just he had it kind of working for a little bit there where they were just, they didn't have great personnel, but it was just a math problem. They were forcing teams into mid-rangers and protecting the rim. That's really broken down the last 3 years or so. Actually, really three of the last 4 years, they've just had absolutely atrocious defenses. And yeah, it's tough with the two small guards. You're kind of limited in being able to switch, but they've never, other than that drop coverage, they've never found anything schematically that's even remotely worked defensively. Whenever they go small, it's just a complete disaster on defense. He's always had some kind of weird rotational decisions at times, I would say. And like, for example, this year, Cantor and Melo together on the second unit. Now he's not playing Derek Jones Jr., who's one of their better defensive players. I would be trying to do that if you can't stop anybody. You know, he's playing Rondae Hollis-Jefferson on a 10-day over Derek Jones Jr., for example, now, like starting him for some reason, where, and if you're not playing Derek Jones Jr. because he can't shoot, putting Rondae Hollis-Jefferson in there probably doesn't make a ton of sense either. And they're just enough inexplicable things. In the press conference, I think this is something that Quick pointed out as well, where he just doesn't give you the idea that he's really kind of confident, in control, really has a great process behind some of the decisions that he's making. And maybe he does behind the scenes. He doesn't want to talk about it in the press conference. Okay, but he always kind of has this like slightly defensive air to him as well. Yeah. So I think, to me, we kind of know what Terry Stotts is. He's never, other than the development, to me, there's no real huge feather in his cap. But I kind of give the organization maybe a little more credit for that. So I would just, this is just my personal philosophy. I don't think we necessarily disagree on what Stotts is. It's just that I would rather take more of a chance on a guy I perceive as up and coming who might have a little more upside than Terry Stotts. That's kind of my thought on why I have him lower.
Yeah, if this is a coach draft, you're going to pick for more upside, because you know what he is, and you know there's limitations with that.
So did I convince you to move him down or no?
We'll talk about some of these other guys and see. Basically, we're getting into a group of like several guys where you could say basically the same things. The next guy on my list is actually completely different, though. This would be more of an upside play, so you could argue he should have been higher. And we talked about him a bit last week when you brought up Mark Daigneault with Oak City, and that is Taylor Jenkins in Memphis. Where they've gotten a lot out of the personnel defensively. The team has certainly overachieved this year in terms of not having Jaren Jackson all year and still looking likely to finish in the top eight in the West now, it seems like. And you know, it's interesting. There's been a couple weird things. Like he didn't use the challenge at all last year, which was kind of bizarre. And the commitment to a 10-man rotation can be a little much when they don't have 10 NBA players available, which happened a couple times when they had injuries hit. So there's a couple things you can point to, but I think overall you say in the middle of year two that he's he's had a good track record so far, and he's willing to try stuff too, which is interesting. You know, he'll do things like put two men on the inbounder. I don't know if you saw that in like late game inbound situations. Yeah, he double teamed the inbounder to take away his vision, which was really interesting. He's done that a couple times, I don't know. I just think there's an outside the box kind of instinct with him it's not on Nick Nurse's level or anything, but it comes up sometimes and it's interesting.
I really like Jenkins a lot. He was my number 16. It sounds like we're pretty much the same. on him. And like with Mark Daigneault, I really think that he can continue to grow as a coach. Their defense has been way above expectations when you consider how young they are as well. Yeah. And playing with the traditional drop back center to be number 8 in defense is really fantastic. I mean, also to be number 15 on offense with this group. Like, how the hell are they doing that? Shooting. They got like one shooter on the floor at all times, and they're doing it with great transition play. He's brought that over from Milwaukee. Obviously, I think he's installed some of the stuff in that worked in Milwaukee from a system standpoint and having a framework that his players can rely on. But at the same time, he doesn't have nearly the same type of personnel, and he's still been able to succeed at basically playing two bigs all the time. The development has been good. I like the way that they've handled Ja Morant. He's really been in lockstep with the organization from a health standpoint. When Morant was only playing 30 minutes last year coming off the knee surgery, he stuck to that totally fine. So that's been good. I mean, the development, granted, some of the guys that they've brought in have been more prepared than your typical rookies, but, you know, getting effective backup center minutes out of the number 35 overall pick this year, Xavier Tillman and Desmond Bane, number 30 overall pick, and Brandon Clark last year. Kyle Anderson's having the best season of his career. They've gotten some guys to improve their shooting under him as well. D'Anthony Melton is another guy who's been really good for them, who hadn't done much beforehand. I really like everything that he's done. We haven't seen him in an adjustment playoff situation. The play-in game, there are a few foibles there, but he was also dealing with such a limited roster. Like, I wouldn't have expected them to win that game. So I'm very encouraged with Jenkins, and I think he's going to have staying power in this development situation in Memphis. He's kind of grown into himself with the media too, where he was a little awkward last year. I think if you Taylor Jenkins versus Terry Stotts, much rather have Taylor Jenkins. I think he's doing a better job right now, and he's younger and can continue to grow, where you just don't see that probably as much with Stotts.
Right, right.
So did I convince you?
I think maybe you did. Yeah, I think maybe there's a case for moving Jenkins up. Yeah. I was really focused on the longevity part when I did this. So that's why I gave Stotts the advantage. I think Taylor's got an argument. It's going to get interesting now going forward, because now I think, like, next year especially, there's going to be more expectations on this team. So that creates just a different environment.
Especially if they actually follow through and are able to make the playoffs instead of losing in the play-in this year. We'll see how that goes. And if they make the playoffs, we'll get a better idea of kind of what adjustments he's able to make. But I think he's been well above expectations this season with this group, was well above expectations last year. I think both these years he's in the Coach of the Year conversation to me. And so, if they have a healthy group with Jaren Jackson next year, then maybe the expectations will ratchet up a little bit. Oh, there's a gift-giving holiday coming up at the beginning of May, and you've heard me extol the virtues of Hello Tushy, and no doubt you've already purchased one for yourself, because you know that just toilet paper is not getting you clean. But if you really care about those loved ones in your life, don't you want them to be clean as well? If you've bought it, you know that it's extremely easy to install. When they say that anyone can put it together, they mean even your parents. Yes, even your parents can attach the Hello Tushy 3.0 to their existing toilet. No electricity, no extra plumbing, no tech support, and it will cut toilet paper use by 80%, paying for itself in just a few months. Plus, it also comes with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. Have your parents join millions of happy Hello Tushy customers right now. Give the gift of a clean butt. Go to hellotushy.com/PER, easy to remember, /PER, and that'll get you 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our listeners at hellotushy.com/PER for 10% off. That's hellotushy.com/PER. Don't forget that /PER to let them know that you came for us. Apropos, given we are going to do a locker room hangout at the end of this show, to let you know that this episode is brought to you by Locker Room, the first social audio platform made for sports fans. The app is free to download, and once you're in, you can talk with me, other fans, athletes, and insiders in real time about your favorite team or sport. I host two rooms on Locker Room, one with my partner Danny LaRue at 6 Eastern, 3 Pacific on Tuesdays. And then this one with John starting at 2 Eastern, 11 Pacific. Time may vary, but generally that's when it is. Check my Twitter at NateDuncanNBA for updates on that. So you can get in, join the conversation, have a conversation with us. Go download the free Locker Room app now. It's available on all iOS devices. You create a profile, you link your Twitter, and you join the NBA group for the latest league updates. I'm at NateDuncanNBA. You can be notified when my room goes live. That's the Locker Room app on all iOS devices. Another guy that I had in this group is Steve Clifford. He's my number 17.
Wow. Okay.
Where did you
have him? Yeah, it's interesting. I had him around there. I had him a little bit lower. You know, Steve Clifford and Stan Van Gundy are kind of right there. I mean, it's the same coaching tree and everything. They're trying to do the same things. And then you can sort of debate who's been more effective in doing that. Steve Clifford has never had super talented teams, was able to milk playoff spots out of both Charlotte and Orlando with really, you know, fairly average rosters. I think offensively, you know, he's more of a defensive coach, I think, we're being honest. is that a tactful way to put it? I don't know. They've never done anything that really blows your mind, but
let me push back on that just a little bit. I think some of the stuff that they did with Vucevic, running more stuff through him at the elbows, they have given their personnel, I think that they at least have been able to find some plays that work for them, like that Vuce screening Fournier out of the corner, wide pin down, and then popping out to three is something that teams have struggled to guard over the years. And there are at least a few things that they've been able to get, and given how limited their personnel is, I wouldn't argue that they've underperformed on offense. They've had, you know, low teens, high 20s when they've had Vucevic there. That's probably about what their talent would indicate.
Definitely more of a win now guy from that like Thibodeau mold, I think. And I don't think player development has been a huge priority. I mean, they did bring Markelle Fultz along nicely, although I think that was, you know, pretty heavily an organizational imperative. And I'd say, you know, what's happened with Mo Bamba, I think, has been a little disappointing, just in terms of not even getting him on the floor to play guys who, you know, were fine, decent. I mean, Kent Birch isn't a bad player, but it's just you got to think a little bit about the long term of the organization versus just winning that game today.
Yeah, well, I think the organization did seem pretty focused on making the playoffs the last couple of years. And remember, they made the playoffs in 2019 because he stopped playing Mo Bamba. They gifted Mo Bamba minutes for the first 4 months of the year. They had like a negative 15 net rating when he was out there. And then as soon as they started playing Kent Birch, they go on like a 22-8 run or whatever it is to make the playoffs and get completely destroyed by Toronto in the first round. And then Bamba had some injury issues as well. So, and has struggled with coming back from COVID. Now he's playing, but it's, at some point you got to earn it. I mean, I think they did gift him some minutes early on, and they're just like, hey, we actually have a decent team here. Like, we can't afford to be playing this guy. I mean, I'll put it this way. I did not like that pick for them at the time. And I think he's gotten enough chances to where it's pretty clear that he's not ready to contribute right now. I mean, it's one thing if they just didn't play at all. I slightly disagree with you on that one. There's some other players that haven't developed amazingly well offensively. I mean, like John Isaac, considering how little he's actually been able to play, the fact that he's developed as well as he has defensively, like, I don't think anyone saw him as a like defensive player of the year type of player when he got drafted. So they've gotten him into being a level, which has been impressive.
We also got to ding him for the love fest with Dwayne Bacon.
I mean, with a last name like that, I guess since you're a vegetarian, you don't get that. That's not too good. But then again, there's not really anyone else that's been healthy to play. Like James Ennis misses time with a calf injury every 3 seconds. It's been, they've been above expectations this year. They've continued to play hard most of the year. I think in the playoffs, he's done okay. Probably you would argue maybe they should have won that 2016 series against the Heat, the one year that he was in with Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
but that was I think he's solidly in this group. I guess you could argue like him or Thibodeau. I'd probably rather have him. I think he sands off a little bit more of the rough edges of Thibodeau, and you still get most of the good things about him. Right. So I think he's just a solid coach. He's someone, I don't see him as a high upside guy, but he's also someone who's going to come in and give you some competence right away. And particularly just the way that he's gotten these teams to defend with Nikola Vucevic. Chicago's finding out how difficult that is right now.
Yeah.
That's been pretty impressive.
Certainly.
So where did you have Clifford ranked?
I had him at 21.
Okay, so who are some of the other guys that you had above?
So let's talk about Stan Van Gundy. Like, am I giving him too much credit for 2009? Is that like too long ago?
I've got him at number 24. So yeah, I fear so.
The Pelicans have been a disappointment to me, especially at the defensive end. I thought he would fix more of the things that were obviously not right with them a year ago, and it hasn't quite happened.
Yeah, the one thing I would give him credit for this year is the point Zion thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly the way that I was hoping that Zion would be used when he came out of school. He wasn't really capable of doing that physically last year either. But that's been really awesome. And your number one thing is to develop Zion Williamson, and they've done that. But I do think you would be hard-pressed to point to anything else that's happened this year that's really been good. Admittedly, with a bunch of injuries. But
yeah.
It
does feel like if you had told me that Zion would play this much and play this well, I would not have projected this to be their record.
No. And he's part of the issues are roster construction. Eric Bledsoe has been terrible. That aspect of the trade is not looking good. The three first round picks was nice.
The whole Adams thing was silliness.
The Stephen Adams, Jackson Hayes, I mean, that's been tough. Hayes is playing a little bit better. They're getting a little bit more out of him. Ingram is kind of doing about the same as he did last year. He hasn't really taken a further step forward. They tried this defense to be kind of Bucks like protecting the rim a ton and giving up threes, but they didn't actually get the forcing them to shoot a low percentage at the rim part of the protecting the rim.
they did the give up threes part, though. They did that. They executed the shit out of that.
Yeah, and again, you know, your personnel is not amazing. Stephen Adams to me is probably a little overrated as a defensive center, and Zion is not good. Ingram is not good. The guards are fine, but that's you can only go so far with those guys defensively. There's not really anything to hang your hat on, and that's, I don't even think he's like a terrible coach or anything. I just like some of these other guys better. I think the state of the profession is pretty good.
I think that's what you get into a little here.
Yeah, so for me, here's some of the guys that I had above Van Gundy. I did have Stotts above him at 23. I had them kind of in the same tier, a tier below some of the other guys we've been talking about in the teens. I had Nate McMillan at number 18 and James Borrego at number 20, both of those in a higher tier than Van Gundy.
Those are my next two guys. I had them 19 and 20.
Yeah, McMillan, you didn't like what they were doing in Indiana. There were too many mid-rangers. They weren't shooting enough threes. They didn't run enough. But you felt like, hey, you know, do you really want to do this? Indiana, like, you kind of have a good thing here. I understand why they made the change. Also, just from a personality standpoint, he was not popular there in their locker room. It seemed that Jay Michaels had a lot of reporting on that he's just kind of, he's not willing to hold these darn millennials' hands the way that you need to these days. But he's coming into Atlanta, and yes, they have overcome some injuries and their schedule's gotten easier, but it's impossible to argue at this point that he's not doing better than Lloyd Pierce was. And this team apparently needed some of his kind of veteranosity coaching of, all right, we're going to slow it down. We're going to get into sets. We're going to make sure that everyone's involved. We're going to be more meticulous. And that's unequivocally has worked for this Hawks team.
Yeah. I think he's shown that he can get a lot of mileage defensively out of pretty average talent, especially in the regular season. And I didn't want to overweigh this Hawks bounce either. I mean, he's had an entire career before this. I mean, we kind of know what he is. And so the other reason I couldn't put him any higher is that he sucks in the playoffs. Like, I don't know how else to put it. Like, he's been really bad in the postseason. Like, even going back to Portland, that first year when they just let Yao Ming go one-on-one in game one, and that basically ended the series right there.
Yeah, I think that was 2009, which was, that was really really the only really year that he had. I guess they were in the next year too, but Roy was already injured at that point.
Yeah,
but yeah. I mean, they have definitely had some pretty miserable collapses. I think the McMillan stat that is going to live with him for a long time until he has some more playoff success is that they had the closest sweep in NBA history back in 2017, where they got swept, but were only negative 16 for the series. That just kind of perfectly encapsulates where he's been. And last year they had no answers for Miami switching defense, although after Miami beat the Bucks, that series didn't look as terrible. They didn't have Sabonis last year either. The year before they didn't have Oladipo, so it was pretty rough going against Boston. But you know, you'd like them to win a game or two in some of these series. And then I thought actually maybe his worst coaching job was in that 2018 series where they honestly should have beaten the Cavs.
They definitely should have
beaten the first round. And you know, things like just very old school we're gonna take Victor Oladipo out because he's got two fouls in the first quarter even though he's a guard, that sort of orthodoxy. I do think in Atlanta they're shooting more threes. We've seen less of just him being like totally stayed the way he was in Indiana, but there's two teams in a row now where they just during the regular season, like, his teams have outperformed their talent, I would say.
So
I mean, that's when you're talking about him, you know, we're getting to what are in theory below average coaches now. If you can do that in the regular season, you probably don't deserve to be any lower than this, is my thinking.
Absolutely.
You know, and so that's the reason why I have him in a higher group than, say, Stotts or Van Gundy or Dwayne Casey or one of the other veteran coaches that's in that group.
Sure.
Billy Donovan. How about Borrego? What have you made of him in Charlotte this year?
I think he's done a really good job in a not great organization. You know, kind of there's like some structure there. There is some player development that's happened. I just feels like everyone's kind of on the same page. He's been able to get a lot of that out of them offensively, I feel like, and been able to really get by without a legitimate center for a lot of the year, just with smoke and mirrors. And so I think it's been a pretty good performance there. I you know, if you had said that they would have the injuries they've had this year, I don't think anyone would have picked them to be sitting around 500 and hanging out in the playoff race.
Well, how on earth this team with its personnel, you mentioned the lack of a center, is 19th in defense? I just have no clue, right? I mean, they're basically the same as from 20 to 16 in terms of defense, like right in that same range, according to Clean the Glass. And that's just, they've junked it up a ton. Matt Moore was talking about this on Danny's podcast a bit ago, that they are very effective, according to the Second Spectrum data, as a switching defense, and they'll throw in some bullshit zone as well, as something against the Knicks last night, even though they lost. They're just finding ways to junk it up. And yeah, there's only so much of a ceiling that you can have doing that type of stuff. But in the regular season, particularly this shortened year, to get guys connected enough that they can change up their defense a little bit, teams don't have that much time to prepare for them. And they're just, you know, if you do a lot of switching, you can at least force teams to run the clock down a little bit, make them shoot from the outside. They're giving up basically the most threes in the league right now, which seems to be a calculated choice. But for a team that has no rim protection, you got to take away the rim first, and they're doing that. So it's given them a chance to compete, at least, on most nights. So that's been impressive. He hadn't done much before this year to really wow me. He's actually moved up quite a bit, I think, in my rankings from last year. And some of the development stories there, Devontae Graham, Terry Rozier, LaMelo Ball, obviously.
Malik Monk has been showing a pulse this year.
Yeah, Miles Bridges has gotten a lot better defensively this year, I think, and as a shooter. PJ Washington has been a solid young player for them as well. So yeah, you got to start feeling pretty good about that, and we'll see if they make the playoffs this year. We'll get more of a sense of him as a playoff coach. But I just like the way that he's just been willing to try stuff, willing to do things unconventionally, even when you're giving up a ton of threes. It kind of looks bad. It's like, hey, look at the math, we're 19th in defense. And you know, granted, maybe the story is a little bit different for them if they're not winning three games more than expected. They've been awesome in close games this year, which probably is a little bit more luck luck than anything, at least at this point. But
yeah,
still, you got to feel pretty good about that. Even for them to be four games under 500 instead of one right now would be extremely impressive, given what I thought they would be. I thought they would be, you know, a 30 win team over the course of an 82 game season this year.
Yep. Yeah.
So yeah, they've been well above expectations. So yeah, that rounds out my top 20. Is there anyone else that you had in your top 20?
No.
Well, in that case, John, I think it is time to anoint the Michelob Ultra Coach of the Week. James Borrego. He's junking it up. The Charlotte Hornets are having a ton of fun out there. LaMelo Ball might be one of the most fun players to watch. Charlotte Hornets fans are enjoying it, and it's only worth it if you enjoy it with 2.6 carbs and 95 calories. Joy creates success. Enjoyment isn't the end game, it's the whole game with Michelob Ultra. Are you happy because you win, or do you win because you're happy? We'll have to ask James Borrego that question. James Borrego, the Michelob Ultra Coach of the Week. If you're hiring for your company, what you need is help making your short list of quality candidates. You don't need 500 candidates who just applied with no regard for what the actual qualifications are. You need Indeed instead. You can post, screen, and interview all on Indeed. You can also use skill tests to winnow down the field of applicants. And using Indeed overall will, on average, reduce the amount of time you spend on hiring by 27%. You only pay for the candidates that meet your must-have qualifications, and you can schedule and complete video interviews in your Indeed dashboard. They've got over 130 skills tests, or you can even add your own. According to Talent Nest, Indeed delivers four times more hires than all other job sites combined. So you're getting the high-quality candidates, you're saving time, and ultimately, getting the applicants that are right for you. Get started right now with a free $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/locked, the name of this network. Get a $75 credit at Indeed.com/locked. Indeed.com/locked. Offer valid through June 30th. Terms and conditions apply. All right, who you want to talk about next here in this the low 20s?
You want to talk about Dwayne Casey?
I mean, not really.
it's just like a shoulder shrug, right? It's just like, okay.
Yeah, I mean, he's
all
totally
right.
Competent.
He's doing right? his like, job I this wouldn't... year, actually. He's developing their younger players, and you know, but this is a tank season at the end of the day. You're just not going to have a lot to evaluate with him.
Yeah. He does, I think he's in hot water with Troy Weaver because he won both of the Weaver Bowls against OKC. Despite the fact that he tried extremely hard to lose those. But, I mean, during his time in Detroit, I mean, even going back to the last Blake Griffin year, I can't find anything to complain about what's happened there. Now, they have had 2 years in a row of winning way fewer games than expected based on their point differential.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, and they were actually trying to win for the first half of last year.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I can't chalk that up to much other than just bad luck at this point in the regular season. I mean, you just don't see much consistency on that metric from year to year. Certainly not someone who has a great playoff record, and when your coach, or I'm sorry, when your GM comes into the locker room screaming at you because you didn't double team LeBron James on the last possession of the game, that's never a great sign for what you've done as a playoff coach. And maybe he would improve if they got back there. They are a long way away from there, but
yeah,
I think he's been totally competent. He's been happy playing the young guys. Schematically, I haven't seen anything that I've hated. They've gotten Jeremy Grant has been given some leash to do better. They got a lot out of Derrick Rose before they traded him. They got a lot out of Blake Griffin using him as a point forward in 18-19 before he broke down. Isaiah Stewart has improved under his watch. Sadiq Bey has looked pretty good. Casey has always done a good job of developing young players coming over from Toronto, where they did a really good job of that. So
they are 16th in defense too.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable, again, just considering the overall situation there. And you wouldn't point to anybody on this team as being like some unbelievable defender. So, yeah, that's pretty good as well. I mean, that's part of why they've been competent this year. And given their offensive talent, I mean, Jeremy Grant bombing away is the number one option yet. I mean, not a surprise that they are a poor defense or offense. I mean, I think actually being 26th is somewhat of an accomplishment given the talent
right.
on hand offensively. So, I mean, I probably... I should probably actually have Casey at the top of this group. He's got a decent argument to be in this tier above. I think it's just he's kind of been in purgatory for a couple of years, and it's just hard for him to have done much.
Yeah.
Maybe that's unfair to him, but I just can't get that excited about him either.
Yeah. Okay. I think we got two great unknowns here, who I just kind of put in the mid-20s and shrugged my shoulders. Like, I had Mark Daynall with this group too, but Chris Finch and Stephen Silas, where we're still kind of learning about them and we don't have a lot to evaluate yet, especially with the teams they have.
I had to put Silas in my bottom tier in the 27 to 30 range. They obviously, it's been a miserable situation in Houston. You know, I think he does. There are raves about him as just a good communicator, good emotionally intelligent coach. But they shouldn't be this bad. Like, they had all their guys and they got just completely destroyed by Miami, who was playing nobody the other night. Like, this team has been playing below its talent level, I would say, for much of the season. And yes, they've had the injuries, they've had the turmoil, they've had guys coming in and out. Like, I get all of that, but I think they should be a little bit better defensively than they've been. You know, they've been bombing away from three. This is one of the few teams that I would say is actually shooting too many threes over the last 20 years, where I would have said that. And they are like process Sixers level of shooting threes and missing them. So I'm not going to tell you that he's terrible. Like, I don't have enough to evaluate that, but I just think there hasn't been anything good that I can point to at all. And that kind of gets you down into this bottom group, even if we don't like the record so far isn't good. And so you got to just be in the bottom for me. I mean, maybe there's an argument that he should be better than Luke Walton, Scott Brooks, and JB Bickerstaff, just because those guys have kind of established themselves as being lower and he hasn't yet. But I mean, they've been awful, and I can't really come up with anything that they've done well so far. So that's why I have him down here, but maybe I'm being too harsh on him. I can acknowledge that.
Well, I mean, I had him 25th, 26th. I mean, I guess I had those guys 24, 25, 26, and just had question marks next to all three of them. I just had him down there just because we just don't know that much about him yet.
Well, so for me, I'll tell you why I had Finch higher than him, even though we haven't seen much. Number one, Finch has a very good reputation for what he's done offensively as an assistant. Number two, he's implemented changes as soon as he came in to just put the ball in Karl Anthony Towns' hands more. You've got stuff like Towns ISOing at the top of the key against other centers, and Towns has been playing really well under him. Since Russell came back, they've actually been pretty competitive. I just think offensively, I've liked the changes that they've made. Their offense has been more free-flowing. Anthony Edwards is playing better under his watch as well. And yes, he was replacing Ryan Saunders, who is not doing a good job. Mm-hmm. But I think you can point to specific things that he's implemented that have improved the team so far, whereas you can't necessarily for Silas, to me. I think Minnesota has been at or above expectations since Fitch came in, and I'd say Silas has been below expectations with this Houston group. So that's why I granted, small sample size, both of these coaches a year from now can do a lot to change your opinion. I mean, I'm just kind of basing it on what we've seen and trying to slot them in and noting the uncertainty. But I think Finch, to me at least, has shown something, whereas I can't point to anything that Silas has shown.
Yeah, that's fair. I did have Finch one spot higher than Silas, but
well, I guess the difference is that I have Silas in a lower tier than Finch. So I have him firmly in the 21 to 26 tier.
Oh, okay.
As opposed to the 27 to 30 tier.
Okay.
Here's anything else you want to say on Finch at all?
No, let's move on.
One guy that I probably the hardest to rank for me in this second half group is Nate Bjorkgren. What have you seen from him this year?
Okay. I had him 29th.
Oh, baby.
I'm a little worried about him. And you know, Indiana is like hanging in there, even though they've had a bunch of injuries. So I respect that. But the thing that really worries me is that I feel like he's just doing what Toronto would have done and not really accommodating for the fact that he doesn't have the same personnel.
Explain.
Just in terms of like all the ball pressure and the going over screens all the time, and the way they play defense, and you know, they'll go to zones a bunch, but I don't think they're very good at it. It just strikes me that like he's basically doing an impression of Nick Nurse.
But Nick Nurse is good.
Yeah, maybe, but it's like, he's like
right? Like, I'll take like the non-union equivalent of Nick Nurse. Absolutely.
what's your impression?
Well, I guess I have been troubled that they haven't been that good this year. I think that their injuries, not only, and there was the Oladipo situation earlier in the year, and if you just look at the raw games missed, it's not necessarily that bad, but they always seem to have guys in and out of the lineup, whether it's Brogdon, whether it's Turner, whether it's Sabonis. They haven't had TJ Warren all year, which has killed them, and they basically have no wing size guys on the entire team. Like, Justin Holiday is like their three and their four in some lineups.
Yeah, they've been playing Jeremy Lamb as a backup four. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's been difficult. Lamb, another guy who's coming back from injury this year. And I do think that the idea of, hey, let's funnel everything in to Miles Turner is a sound idea as well. And Turner has been pretty effective. They've defended reasonably well when Turner has been on the floor this year. Not so well when it's been Sabonis at center. I think maybe I will admit that I'm giving him more of the benefit of the doubt because he's kind of willing to try stuff. One thing he has done that's been effective from Toronto is having them get the ball out of bounds really quickly, especially after makes, doing a little bit more running than they did under McMillan. McConnell's has
been especially with TJ McConnell. Yeah.
I mean, they have gotten more out of McConnell even than McMillan did, and that, you know, he's not a Toronto style of player. So McConnell getting all these steals in the backcourt and stuff, like, he's kind of been unleashed even as a limited player to give them some effectiveness. I just, and supposedly the players really like him there. They've been very complimentary of him in the media in a way that they weren't of McMillan. Yeah, it'd be nice if they won a few more games. I will admit that. But I do think that he's forward thinking enough in terms of running and some of the defensive stuff. Like, they went to the box and won on Curry earlier this year and won a game that they had no business winning in San Francisco because they did that, and the Warriors struggled with it. So there were, like, some of that Toronto stuff is pretty good. That's why we like Nick Nurse for it. And so I think being mini Nurse, I'm kind of giving him credit for that. I guess you're giving him a demerit. And also with the injury. Now, if they come back and everybody's healthy next year and they're 500, yeah, he will rock it down to the bottom for me. But I mean, I think 29 is, like, you're saying he's worse than Luke Walton, Scott Brooks, and J.B. Bickerstaff?
There was one of them I said he was not worse than. We'll get to that. I might have been too harsh with this. Here's where I realize I'm being too harsh is because I put the other first year coaches in the mid 20s. So at the very least, I should have him in the same spot. Give him more time to prove my initial impression wrong or right.
Yeah, I get your idea that maybe there's a little bit too much inflexibility with this. All right, we're gonna have Sabonis out on the floor, running guys off the 3-point line and funneling them into Turner. Yeah, maybe there could be a different approach there, but I also, he's gotten them shooting more threes. I think that's good. Even if they haven't gone in it as much, but yeah, I mean, they've just been so racked by injuries, it's been tough. You know, LeVert didn't come back for a while. I mean, that's one thing where I expected them to start playing better once LeVert came back, and they haven't. That's probably the one thing where I felt like they were really at expectations until that happened. But then they've had this Sabonis injury and this Turner injury and Brogdon out of the lineup. It's been tough. So I kind of liked him. I liked the hire beforehand. Maybe I'm still too stuck on that prior, but I also am not going to crap on him for this year when it's been pretty rough for him. So we got a few other guys we haven't talked about yet. My bottom four, but although I still have him in tier four, and that's Billy Donovan.
Yes, we have a reigning coach. He won coach of the year last year, didn't he? Or did he come in second or third or something?
I can never remember anymore.
I don't care enough about coach of the year to retain this. Okay, maybe he didn't win. Maybe he came in second or third. But did a good job with OKC
Nurse was coach of the year last year.
So yeah. Did a really good job OKC regular season last year, did a not good job in the playoffs, and that's been pretty consistent his whole career. And I think he's he had Chicago in the playoff race there, and I think post trade he's kind of struggled to figure out what he has and how to best utilize it. But what's your impression of him?
Competent, good representation of the organization. He's the ultimate safe choice. Let's find somebody who's not going to kill you and not going to embarrass ourselves.
Yeah, just extreme vanilla, right?
Yeah.
And kind of on autopilot sometimes.
I mean, what does he do well? And as a coach, I struggle to see what that is. They've taken a step back defensively this year, which I would have predicted, honestly, as much as shit as Jim Boylan got. I mean, this Chicago team is now 23rd in defense, and they were 12th last year. And granted, they did that by forcing a bunch of turnovers, but, you know, and it looked really stupid against the good teams, but it also actually worked. He definitely saw some regression from Wendell Carter under his watch. Kobe White didn't develop either. Both those guys got replaced in the starting lineup and not necessarily helping them win. They've had some pretty ugly collapses at the end of games where they haven't been able to score as well. And that's when, sometimes it's bad luck. This one, though, they really have struggled to get some of the right lineups out there at times. So I'm not going to like crap all over him. It's like, oh, this guy's awful in the regular season. But again, there's a lot of great coaches out there. And he to me is, if we were going to say that Terry Stotts was sort of the like boring, competent choice, he's like kind of a worse version of Terry Stotts to me.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah. I think that's a
good way. Give him credit, though. Granted, this was 5 years ago, but I did think he actually coached a really good playoffs his first year in OKC against the Spurs and against the Warriors, both teams that in theory were superior, that he caused big time problems for with some specific adjustments. But since then, I agree, it's been pretty poor.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could. I mean, they took Houston to seven last year. They weren't supposed to win that series. The three guard lineup together, that was okay. You know, I thought he did a good job last year, but also a lot of it was Chris Paul just happened to be 19th in the NBA in minutes played when people expected him to be 250th.
Yeah.
So, all right, we got a little time left here before we get to your speaker request. That is coming soon. We talked about Silas already. So give me, you said you had Bjorkren at 29. So give me your rankings of the remaining coaches we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah, I had Bickerstaff and then Scott Brooks, and then I had Luke Walton last.
You didn't recuse yourself on Bickerstaff?
Well, I didn't recuse my. Nah, it's been enough time has passed now that I think I could talk a little bit. I mean, he's never been in a situation that was really primed for success, is the thing you could say about Bickerstaff. But it's his fifth, at least partial, season now, and there's never been a moment where you're like, oh, they're really massively overachieving here. So it's just tough to rank him ahead a lot of these other guys.
Yeah, they were 10-11. I thought they were massively overachieving at that point, but their point differential was never been good this year, and then they've actually won 4.5 games more than expected this year, despite being 20-37.
Yeah. So
that goes into it for me as well. And Darius Garland's playing a little better this year. You got to give him credit for that. I give him credit for trying Larry Nance at the three and kind of making Larry Nance into a really high level of player at times. But it's disturbing to me how few threes they take. That's the concern about him, is that he's been reluctant to embrace some of the more modern principles. You've got these two guards who are really good three-point shooters that you're trying to make the next Dame and CJ, except they take half as many threes as Dame and CJ do. And even when they shoot a good percentage, also, this has been one of the worst passing teams. You can't really point to anything that he's done from a system standpoint offensively, other than maybe getting Larry Nance a little bit more involved. They haven't figured out a way to get much out of Kevin Love, even when he has been healthy. And defensively, they've kind of been, I mean, maybe you're doing well to be 22nd in defense.
I think early in the year, they were forcing so many turnovers, and
it
was kind of impressive that they were able to do that, especially with a kind of a small, bad backcourt defensively with Garland and Sexton. So they had that going for them. I just, that hasn't really sustained itself, though. I mean, they've had a lot of lineup changes and variants. I mean, you look at some of the dudes who are out there some night and you're like, oh my goodness.
They've been playing the Lamar Stevens and Dean Wade, who I think I can never tell whether the Cavs announcers are calling him D Wade or Dean Wade. I really hope they're not calling him D Wade. I think that one is taken.
Yeah. No, there's been a lot of different lineups and whatnot, and Cleveland this year. And then the charity minutes for Okoro, I think, have hurt them too.
Yeah, although he's the only guy on their team who can defend. So yeah, I understand him being out there. And I mean, that's I'm not blaming him for playing him. I don't think you are either, to be clear. But just that, that's something that's made it more difficult to succeed. But, well, I mean, I'll tell you what. Okoro is a shitload better than Jetty Osman, who might have been the worst player in the NBA this year when you consider his defense and the fact that he's got like a 23 usage and he's shooting like below 50% true shooting and he's not really a defensive 47. Player, but in any event, like that was one where I looked at the stats and I was just like, holy shit. Like I didn't realize, like I thought he was maybe like a competent small forward in my mind. Anyway, all right, that's enough on him. I actually have JB 30th, but
okay.
But you could certainly make an argument for Luke Walton or Scott Brooks in this position. So who was 30th for you?
I had Walton 30th. So Scott Brooks to me is the lesser version of Billy Donovan, who is the lesser version of Terry Stotts, right? And Oklahoma City, this is like Oklahoma City's coaching tree, right? Like it went from Scott Brooks vanilla one to Billy Donovan vanilla two. Brooks's vanilla is a little too vanilla. I mean, to his credit, he's
Billy Donovan is vanilla bean, whereas Scott Brooks just regular vanilla.
Yeah.
I mean, how these guys being 24th in offense, I mean, that's pretty atrocious. Like this was supposed to be a good offense this year. That's how they were going to get there.
They're built to be an offensive team and they're still not good at it.
Yeah. And personnel hasn't been amazing. He's had to integrate some of these young dudes with a team that's also supposed to win. And I don't know that the development there has been unbelievable. I think he's shown at least some new tricks with like the way they used Bertans last year, for example. But I mean, record is what the record is. These guys have underperformed pretty much every year except for Brooks's first year. There's too many good coaches out there to me to be wasting your time with Scott Brooks. And with his contract expiring, I think Washington will likely come to the same conclusion this offseason.
Yeah.
So, and then Walton, we can finish up on him quickly. I know we got to get to these speaker requests. But the blueprint for reasonable success was created by Dave Yeager, and they just haven't done that. Like, they don't run the way that they did with Yeager. That was, like, the easiest thing to implement, and Dave Yeager was screaming himself hoarse on the sidelines, trying to get him to run every time. Luke Walton hasn't been doing that. They haven't run as much. I don't think that this team's defensive personnel is so bad that they should be, like, you know, the worst defense in the NBA.
Exactly.
Necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless they're playing badly at center, but...
Giant red flag there. Yeah.
Yeah, like that. Like I thought they could provide some competent defense. They've had competent defensive years recently. So yeah, I mean, Walton seems like he's headed for the end as well. And just going quickly through
his year in LA was no prize either. I mean, you can't just blame the Kings for this.
Yeah, I thought his first year in LA, they defended above their weight. But obviously the last year with LeBron, LeBron wasn't too happy with him. It seemed pretty clear. So although worth noting, they were like 24-11 before LeBron got hurt initially, but it does seem like Luke is kind of, there's sort of an inmates running the asylum feel to some of these Walton teams where you just get these weird quotes from players' fathers and like just little acts of insubordination, Buddy Hield. Yeah. He seems like he's kind of at the edge of competence here. I liked him initially, but clearly the record just hasn't been very good. Mm-hmm. Worth noting, by the way, that we have a pretty good record on this in terms of at least what organizations think of their coaches, because we had Ryan Saunders and Jim Boylan, Alvin Gentry towards the bottom, Mike Miller towards the bottom last year, and all those guys were let go. So
that's true.
Most protein bars are awful. I like to work out. I've tried basically all of them. And before Built Bar, I'd resigned myself to the idea that they're all going to taste like a rock quarry. But now, with 18 amazing flavors, the improved Built Bar is even more delicious. There's 6 new flavors: caramel brownie, cookies and cream, cherry barcia, lemon almond cheesecake, carrot cake, apple almond crisp. Of course, there are classics like raspberry, peanut butter, double chocolate, peanut butter brownie. The bars are covered in 100% chocolate. That makes a huge difference. By the way, their They're soft and easy to chew, but they're still great for the health conscious person. For example, peanut butter, 19 grams of protein, 180 calories, 5 grams of sugar, 5 grams of net carbs. Great for a keto diet. And you can even get a free cooler with purchase while supplies last. Go to BuiltBar.com, use the promo code LOCKED15, and you'll get 15% off your next order. Use promo code LOCKED15 for 15% off at BuiltBar.com. If the last year has taught us anything, it's that we don't really need bricks and mortar stores anymore. Going to your local auto parts store really was not a good experience to begin with. In that front area, they never really had anything other than just totally generic stuff. And then you would go to that desk, you probably had to wait in line while the one person who was there at the counter tried to find the part that the person in front of you wanted. And then finally, when you got up there, you'd ask for your part and they'd say, oh yeah, we can order that. It'll be here in 2 weeks. Well, great. I could have just stayed at home and used rockauto.com, got my part faster, and saved a bunch of money. Chain stores at different price tiers for professional mechanics and do-it-yourselfers. RockAuto.com's prices are the same for everybody and are reliably low. So go to rockauto.com right now. See all the parts available for your car and truck. You just put your make and model in there. Write Locked On in their How Did You Hear About Us box so they know that we sent you. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. rockauto.com. Okay, let's get to some speaker requests here. Sorry it has taken so long. We got 9 of these, so we're going to try and roll through here. But Pokusevsky is first. Let's get to it, Poku. And so, reminder, we're recording this as a podcast, so just start talking. And if we can't hear you, we'll let you know. You are in, Poku.
Hey, guys. What's going on? First-time caller, long-time listener. Sadly, I'm not actually Poku. My name's Johnny, and I'm a long-time Thunder fan from Hong Kong.
Oh, yeah.
My question is related to this year's restricted free agency and how you guys would expect teams with max cap space to approach the RFA market, especially since most of the big names in the unrestricted free agent market have signed extensions already. I was originally thinking about how the Thunder should use their cap space this offseason. They have $55.5 million on their books for next season, including Al Horford's $27 million. And they also have a bunch of expiring trade exceptions. But trading for bad contracts doesn't seem to make sense since most of the Sour 16s have already ended. So my logical conclusion was that OKC and other teams with max cap space this offseason, such as the Spurs, Mavs, Hornets, and Knicks, they should be throwing big offer sheets at RFAs. Like guys like Lonzo Ball, John Collins, Duncan Robinson, Kendrick Nunn, Devontae Graham, or Gary Trent, or even Talen Horton Tucker. And so I'd love to get your thoughts on how these max cap space teams will approach free agency differently and which RFAs in particular they should target.
Well, I do expect some of these other teams to go after RFAs, like you mentioned. I think the Knicks in particular are a very strong candidate to drop a sheet on Lonzo Ball in particular. I think Oklahoma City is going to sit this one out, though. I think they're going to be a dumping ground for bad contracts again, accumulate even more draft picks, and then maybe a year from now decide to try to jump in. Maybe. But I just don't see them going for the quick fix. I think they're in for the long haul rebuild, and they're not going to get distracted by anything shiny. The one thing that's interesting is Horton Tucker, is because he's young enough that he can fit on the timeline with some of these other guys, and that could be an interesting one, especially if they go full Tyler Johnson on him. And, you know, do the max one that the Lakers would probably really sweat having to match that.
Yeah, that max Arenas offer. A couple things I'll add to what John was saying. I think the teams that are trying to be good next year, those teams are going to be loath to go into the full restricted free agent process, because if you get matched, then you're just left holding a bag of cash when you're trying to be good that the next year. So I would expect the Mavs to be more active in the unrestricted free agent market. Knicks, it'll be interesting to see whether they feel like they want to be assured of getting better or not. They also, potentially with Julius Randle needing a big new contract in the summer of 22, they might feel like they want to keep their powder dry for that a little bit. But yeah, it'll be interesting. There are the restricted free agents are a little bit better, and some of these teams, the Heat, for example, they might blanch a little bit at having to pay $20 million a year for Duncan Robinson. So that'll be fascinating. But I agree with John that OKC, to me, if they can't go the bad contract route, that they're going to kind of chill lot a little bit, save some actual cash. They'll be around the minimum salary again. And you don't want to sign someone who might actually, you know, win you a bunch of games next year as well. So it seems like they're kind of in the multi-year tank mode. Thanks so much for that question. Good to have you on for the first time. Yeah, go ahead.
Personally, I kind of feel like the logical thing for OKC to do is to like sit this one out and tank and like accumulate more draft picks. But the recent signings of like Gabriel Deck and V. Krejci is in like Dallas and OKC, and he's just hanging around the team and all that. And there's rumors that they're going to bring over Vasily Micic next season. So I just can't shake the feeling that they're somehow going to try and be good or go through the plane or something.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, John.
Yeah, I think the Deck contract is filler so that they could get to the minimum salary. Like, I don't see him as any kind of prospect, really. I think they just have a number that they can use in a trade now.
All right. Can I also slip in a short sub-question for my Mavs fan friend? Do you guys think that Devontae Graham or Jalen Brunson is a better fit next to Luka Doncic? Graham has a bit more playmaking and Brunson has a bit more scoring.
Brunson, for sure. Bigger defensively. Yeah. Graham is just too small. Brunson can score inside the arc. Graham can't. So easily Brunson, I would say, to me. Okay, let's... we got... All right,
thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. We'll try and roll through these quickly here. We normally would like to get a little dialogue going, but in the interest of getting to as many people as we can, why don't we just do a quick question and answer. Jay Ochiogrosso, you are on the air. Jay, awesome last name. What's going on? Jay, are you there? Well, I got to say your last name. That was fun, at least. Try and get back in the queue if you can. Let's move to Paul Sadlier.
Hey, guys. Quick question for you about the Utah Jazz and new owner, Ryan Smith. Danny always says ownership is the biggest competitive advantage in the league. I just wanted your quick thoughts on him. And then also if the Dwayne Wade partnership, him buying into ownership there, has any effect on their long-term prospects. Or maybe, John, if you can talk to like roster building or a peek behind the curtain on how something like that affects kind of how you can approach free agency, or if that even has an impact at all, or if that's all just kind of manufactured media.
He's a minority owner. Minority owners in the NBA, I mean, you just don't have that much juice. You don't. Now, they can involve him to some extent. And, you know, that could be helpful maybe at the margins. You know, if you come to a player meeting and Dwayne Wade is there, that could be helpful. You know, like we had, for instance, in Memphis, like we had Justin Timberlake as a minority owner. So occasionally, like if there was a free agent pitch, we would try to see if there was some way to, like, you know, if he could like do a video or something, you know what I mean? Just something to, right. You know. And so at the margins, I think that can help. But no, the things I've seen from Ryan Smith are, A, willing to spend, clearly. So that's a good sign, right? Like they're in the tax this year, didn't even sweat it. The extensions with Gobert and Donovan Mitchell, yeah. It's the same thing. And the only thing I would say is almost too exuberant, though, where like they barely even negotiated on these extensions. They just basically handed the guys a blank check. And I do wonder if those contract numbers are going to end up biting them, especially if Mitchell makes third team all NBA this year. Like that'd be kind of a fail on the part of the Jazz to guarantee him the 30% just for making third team. And that's going to have some serious cap implications going forward.
Yeah, and the player options as well on that. Thanks for that question. I wanted to do this one, actually. This is a fun one. We'll do it real quick. Mark Koo in the chat asks, can you guys do a top three offensive and defensive coaches?
Top three offensive and defensive coaches. Yeah. All right.
I can start.
Like if I'm winning, winning a game today. Yeah. Why don't you start?
Okay. So defensive, I think Frank Vogel would have to be in there for me. Tibbs. I don't know. If it's a regular season game, Tibbs. If it's the playoffs, maybe not. Yeah. Mike Budenholzer.
Nurse.
Pretty good. Yeah. I mean, Nurse has probably got to be in there, though they haven't stopped that many people this year. Yeah. Probably Nurse, Tibbs, and Vogel, maybe. I mean, Steve Clifford is kind of in there, too. There's, you know, Steve Kerr's been a pretty good defensive coach as well. Mm-hmm. Pop usually gets more out of it. it's kind of tough of like, okay, are you, who's the best defensive coach in the playoffs versus who's building a system in the regular season? I mean, Bud's got to be up there for regular season. So let's say to win a playoff game, who do you want as your coach? I'm going to go Nurse, I'll go Steve Kerr, and Frank Vogel. Those would be my three for the playoffs. Regular season would be different. Any arguments there?
What about Spoelstra?
Yeah. Did they really defend that well in the end last year?
They were an offensive team last year.
Yeah.
So I can understand that.
Yeah, and I thought he also, I mean, going way back to 2014, he didn't really have any other options when they were getting housed by the Spurs in the 2014 finals other than the let's just double team the ball and get carved up by their passing over and over again.
Yeah.
That was a while ago, obviously. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
That was a while. I think he's evolved a lot as a coach, actually. That's one of the things I've been really impressed by with him. Like, he's moved, like, if we had done this ranking in 2014, like, he wouldn't be anywhere near where we had him on this one.
Okay, offensive coaches. This one is tough too. I think Rick Carlisle would probably have to be in there, even though they never run. His half court offenses are always awesome.
Quinn Snyder.
Yeah, that's got to be up there too. They've had some offenses that weren't great, but they also didn't have the greatest personnel in the world.
Nash here just because he's running D'Antoni's stuff.
Yeah, that's a possibility for sure.
Brad Stevens?
Yeah, those teams, they never get to the rim and the foul line enough, though. I thought of him, mm-hmm. and I was like, they're not like that unbelievable. I would put Nash up there and Carlisle. I need one more. Like, Snyder is in consideration for me. And how about Spo?
What about Spoelstra on offense?
Yeah, I kind of like him more offensively, although their offenses suck this year, mm-hmm. too. So that's Monty Williams actually would be one that their offense in Phoenix is really impressed me a lot with the number of cuts they get, the number of assists that they get. I think they've punched above their weight offensively the last couple of years, so he might be up there. We haven't seen it from him in the playoffs, so probably got to go Spo, Carlisle, and Nantoni.
Nantoni. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That was a good question. Let's get to Jay. We got you back here. Jay, did it work this time? Are you on?
Hi, I think so.
Awesome.
How are you doing? Hey, great. Hey, so I wanted to ask you guys a question. In addition to watching a lot of NBA, I'm also a follower of some esports, particularly StarCraft. And one of the things that the game designers and administrators do is try to maintain what they call a healthy metagame. Healthy metagame is normally just defined as, is there a variance in strategy, units, composition of the team, or the units that are part of the game? And I do wonder, although I enjoy the aesthetics of 2021 NBA, I do wonder if there is something lacking as far as the diversity of the NBA metagame. It does seem like most teams have, a primary offensive instigator surrounded by a bunch of guys that are, in the 6'5 to 6'7 range, preferably those that could shoot. Sometimes they play with a big man, sometimes not. But I do kind of yearn for some variance in the game so that, a team like the Hollinger Grizzlies with two bigs, countering some of these smaller lineups or other strategies might be effective in the game. So my question is, do you think my diagnosis is correct that there is kind of a staleness in the composition and the strategy of the game? And if so, what are some ways to get around that? I don't necessarily just mean, threes and dunks and that being the strategy, but like, is there a way to get some type of healthy variation in the game?
So let me take this one, John, if you don't mind, because I feel extremely passionately about this one. Certain of our colleagues who obviously I respect, but I disagree extremely strongly with them for saying that there is not enough variation. I think there is far more variation now in tactics and in type of players than there's ever been. I mean, watch the way that Karl-Anthony Towns and Nikola Jokic are playing now. You have teams that have offensive initiating centers from the perimeter. Defensively, there is far more difference in strategy than there has ever been before. Zones, two on the ball in pick and roll, switching, drop back coverage, box and one, all this stuff is much more variation. If you go back and watch a game in the late 80s and the early 90s, half the offensive possessions are, let's put three guys above the three-point line so the other guys have to guard them in illegal defense, and then we're going to throw it into the post with this guy and wait for someone to sprint at him and double team. Like, the game was much more homogeneous back then. There are teams that play fast now. There are teams that play slow as opposed to everybody playing slow. There still is plenty of posting up. That I think is Joel Embiid, Nikola Jokic, some of the guards, that still happens plenty. I think there's more variation now. And just because there's been this idea that everyone's shooting more threes, that to me is not an indication that that there isn't enough variation. I think not only that there's variation, but also that just it's a more aesthetically pleasing style overall. So I think this is the best ever era of basketball by far. There's less fouling now too. So I really like what's happening, and I would be loath to make what I would consider regressive changes. So John, I know you want to get in here as well. What are your thoughts?
I would make one or two subtle changes, actually. I think one of the biggest things, people say it's just threes and layups now. It's because catch and shoot twos have been replaced with catch and shoot threes, actually. Right. It's been virtually the entirety of that. The one thing, we have incentivized the three a bit more because we're giving three-shot fouls, and we've incentivized players to draw garbage three-shot fouls. I think if we went back to making that a two-shot foul, it would even out a little bit. Some of the weighing and you need a little more variation in terms of teams maybe posting up a little more than they do now. Although there's still room for a good post up, for great post up players. I think I'd like to see the pendulum swing at least a little so that there's more opportunity for maybe guys who are good post up players, but not awesome ones, but that still might be a play that makes sense more often. And I think tweaking the balance a little on the three-shot foul might be enough.
Controversial opinion here, especially for someone who was a big man in his playing days. Posting up is like kind of boring. he's gonna put his back to the basket and slowly back down towards the rim, as opposed to like someone driving in and trying to shoot a layup. Like, there's no comparison. I think it's not really that exciting to me.
Yeah, Nate, I do get that. It does seem like there's something, and I definitely agree the aesthetics of this game. I grew up in the 80s and 90s and watched, Rick Smits and Patrick Ewing trade fall away, 12-foot post possessions, which was excruciating. but I do feel like there's something. I mean, I also miss the rogueness of like the Don Nelson teams, that they were just explicitly different than the other team. And I just got a lot of enjoyment about seeing that counter. And I agree that some of the counters are more, there are more counters, and maybe there's more, a lot more nuanced for the more casual viewer. But that is an aspect that I do kind of miss. And maybe it's just the dumb teams got smarter. But there is something that I think could be, something maybe missing.
I will say this. I wish there were more offensive rebounding. I do actually really enjoy offensive rebounding. Thanks for that, Jay. That's a great question. We got time for one more here, and that is going to be one Todd Miller. Todd, how are you?
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Great.
So I wanted to ask about Mike Conley's offseason. It seems like the conventional wisdom is that the Jazz are just going to re-sign him and pay through the nose in luxury tax. but I think it's kind of a sneaky, interesting negotiation, because on one hand, the Jazz can't really replace him in any way. And on the other hand, I don't really see any other teams pursuing Mike Conley. So I don't know if there's any external leverage for him. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that, and what kind of contract you expect him to sign in the offseason.
The contract I would expect him to sign, given the luxury tax implications, is a contract that is actually longer than you would otherwise give for him, but has lower annual dollars. So basically, you're actually stretching the money over a longer period to reduce the luxury tax hit in any one individual year, which could save Utah a lot of money because of the additional multipliers on it. So that would be my expectation. And I do think he's a good bet to re-sign there. And Utah does seem pretty inclined to keep this group together right now and just keep paying. And I think It's also probably where Mike wants to be. I mean, I think the one team that would have a shot at him if they ever got cap space and or needed a point guard would be Indiana, just because of the kind of hometown connection for him. But they're not in a position to do that right now. So I would say Utah would be a strong, strong favorite to retain him.
Yeah, and he's made comments to that effect as well to your colleague Tony Jones at The Athletic. But the two teams that I would see maybe being interested, Dallas with $35
million. Well, Dallas, certainly. I mean, Dallas tried to sign him last time he was a free agent. I don't know if you remember.
I do remember. That's part of what was informing that.
Absolutely.
And the Knicks, too, you could see. I mean, he actually would be a really nice fit in New York. Imagine replacing Elfrid Payton with him. Like that would be pretty good. I think he will at least have some offers in theory, although, you know, who knows? There's probably, I mean, a lot of it depends, too, on what happens in these playoffs, you would think. But I think Utah, in theory, gives them the best chance to win. If they lose in five games to the Lakers in the second round, then he might say, maybe I have a better chance to win in Dallas. And maybe Dallas will offer him more money than Utah can due to the tax concerns.
Speaking of that New York thing, you know, Mike switched to CAA.
Oh, no. Well, that's good. This is a good way to bookend the pod here. Thanks again for all these great questions on Locker Room. Sorry to those who got in that we didn't have a chance to get to, but we'll be back next week, of course. I think it'll probably be at the normal time at 2 Eastern, 11 Pacific, but we'll keep you all posted on Twitter about that. And thanks again for joining us here on Locker Room and the pod. We'll talk to you all next time.